Welcome back to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. On January 21st, the first confirmed case of COVID-19 in the United States was reported by the Centers for Disease Control. The patient near Seattle had recently returned from Wuhan, China, where officials had been dealing with illnesses caused by a novel coronavirus since December. In the following 3 months, more than 750,000 positive cases have been reported, along with more than 42,000 deaths in the U.S. alone. One of the biggest hotspots is just a few blocks away from our Sioux Falls studio at the Smithfield Pork Plant, where at least 725 employees have tested positive. Since that first case in Washington State, our next guest has spent a lot of time there working on the new episode of Frontline, which premieres tonight. Miles O'Brien is the writer, producer, director, and correspondent for Coronavirus Pandemic, A Tale of Two Washingtons. You can see it tonight at 8 p.m. Central, 7 Mountain on SDPB-TV. The film is also available 2 hours earlier on the PBS video app and online at pbs.org/frontline. Miles O'Brien, thank you for being here today. Welcome to the program.
Good morning from Seattle, Lori. Thank you.
I want to talk about patient one here in just a minute, but first let's talk about Seattle, because as you're walking through there, you've been a science writer for a science journalist for more than 30 years, and this feels more like science fiction to you. Tell us a little bit about just the process of reporting on this story and how it's been so different from reporting other science stories throughout the decades.
Well, I came to Seattle as the shutdown began. This was among the first places to do it. It actually was the first place to begin social distancing, working from home, sheltering in place. All those things unfolded here. So I've seen the entire pandemic unfold pretty much from the view of Seattle, and it is surreal here. This is a vibrant city, a wonderful restaurant and music scene. I came here and the streets were all but vacant, took a ferry ride across Puget Sound. It was like a ghost ferry. And so it was the experience that many of us now are becoming accustomed to as we try to hunker down and ride out the worst parts of this pandemic. And it did. You couldn't help but think of some of these, you know, grade B science fiction movies that we've watched over the years that you never thought would really happen. And here we are.
Yeah. All right. Let's talk about patient one. Was Seattle ready? Were the hospitals ready for that first case? And walk us through who this person was and how they, in a lot of ways, had a pretty rapid response to that first confirmed case.
Yeah, he's a 35-year-old, otherwise healthy individual, lives in the Seattle Puget Sound area. Excuse me, I got a frog in my throat this morning. And he went to China to visit family. He was in the Wuhan region for about 6 weeks at the end of 2019 and first part of 2020. He did not go, interestingly, to that wet market that everybody's been talking about where they think the virus might have began. But he got on a plane, arrived in in Seattle on January 15th, and within a few days had some symptoms. And he did everything that he should have. He presented himself to a walk-in clinic. He told them exactly where he had been and how he felt. And what was really interesting to me, and which kind of got me interested in this whole story here, is they immediately saw that for what it was. They connected the dots. They took appropriate protective action for their personnel. They got a nasal swab and got that testing device to the Centers for Disease Control pretty much overnight. And within 24 hours, they had confirmation that this person had COVID-19. It was the first confirmed case in the United States. He was quarantined at home until they got the test back, and then brought by ambulance to a hospital here, mostly for observation. He didn't really require hospitalization, but they wanted to. Didn't really understand the spread just yet and how really there were so many unknown things about coronavirus. There still are, but then it was even more sketchy. And what was really interesting was 3 weeks prior to him presenting at that walk-in clinic with symptoms is the hospital which received him had done a full-up dress rehearsal simulation for a pandemic and the arrival of a very contagious patient into the hospital. And so that drill that they did, they put into action almost exactly as they drilled it 3 weeks prior. And so he ended up in that hospital and was treated there and ultimately recovered.
And this feels like a success story because of the contact tracing occurring around him a little bit, because I think when we say patient one, some people listening could misinterpret, like, this is how this man is how this virus got to the United States. But meanwhile, flights are flying in all over the country from different areas of the world. So talk a little bit about what they then did from a public health standpoint with patient number one to find out if he had exposed anybody else.
Yeah, Lori, I mean, you make a great point. I don't think there's any doubt in anyone's mind that the virus had already been here in the community. It just hadn't been discovered. Either people got what they thought was a cold or the flu and didn't report it, or it was still in the incubation period. But yes, given the travel, particularly this part of the world, most everybody in the epidemiological world assumed when it came to the U.S., it would begin in the West Coast, given the travel pattern. So that all makes sense. So what they did in this case is the state epidemiological investigators interviewed this person, and he was able to identify 60 individuals who he had come in contact, and that means a 10-minute face-to-face conversation over the course of time between his arrival back home and getting sick, which to me is extraordinary that he can remember 60 people. But that's another story that I'd love to hear sometime from him. But in any case, he did that, and they went out to all 60 people and swabbed them, sometimes repeatedly, and they found no evidence of spread, at least initially. And so for a time, they were like, well, that's interesting. And there was a brief moment of optimism. Maybe that case is closed. But ultimately, it was, for people who really study these things, when you're looking at the exponential growth of a virus that we have no immunity to, it was a critical early warning sign. And it wasn't very long before this whole thing exploded here in the Seattle area.
Which brings us to the conversation about testing and this idea of early on, how critical, my question to you is, how critical was the U.S. decision to not use available tests that were made available to us, tests that were developed in Germany, recommended by the World Health Organization? The United States said, no, thank you. Why did we pass on those tests, and what are the consequences of that decision?
Yeah, the testing story is a tough one, right? There were so many missed opportunities. You know, I mean, I think why did the CDC, the most vaunted epidemiological health, public health organization in the world, turn down a test that was up and running and shippable that had been built created in Germany and distributed by the World Health Organization? Why would they say no to that, except to say that the CDC is the gold standard and they do their own thing, right? It may be a little bit of hubris, maybe a little bit of not invented here. What they would tell you is that actually taking a test designed overseas and putting it into the U.S. Market would actually have slowed things down. Maybe there's something to that. I don't know, but it was an emergency. And when they finally got their test out the door, as we all probably know by now, it didn't work. And this was just a crucial, crucial loss of precious time. You know, meanwhile, what I discovered here, Lori, is there was a whole other testing component to this that was not good. There was a local researcher here, a virologist at the University of Washington School of Medicine, Alex Greninger, who the moment that they posted the genetic sequence of the virus online, the Chinese did that, this is January 11th, I believe. The moment that happened, he got busy in his lab just making a homebrew test, and he had success. And he wanted to start, having seen what happened with that first patient, he presumed that there was spread in the community, and there was only one way to find out at that point, which would be to test. And so he wanted to get that test out the door and start just testing patients inside the hospital here that he's a part of to see if anybody with respiratory symptoms, in fact, had coronavirus. But he was blocked by the Food and Drug Administration, all kinds of bureaucratic tangles, 28-page application, 2 weeks to demonstrate the stability of a specimen, on and on it went. And he was unable to get his approval to get his test out the door. And then there's one other story. There was an ongoing flu study here in Seattle for months they had been taking nasal swabs of individuals in the Puget Sound area trying to understand how the flu spreads. Well, this was a tremendous resource on their shelves of samples that would give you an idea of if the virus was here in, you know, writ large. And they tried to get approval to test those samples that they received for the flu, test them for the coronavirus, and they were told they couldn't. So there's, you know, down the road here, all there were people scrambling, trying, understanding the need, that urgent need to try to identify the extent of the problem, and either being rebuffed by bureaucracy or rules, or in the case of the CDC, you know, an unfortunate mistake in the processing of the test. But all of that, when you talk about the exponential growth of the virus, that really, you know, it's hard to catch up to a virus on a good day. But when you're losing weeks because of no testing, you're in much bigger trouble.
On February 2nd, President Trump, in an interview with Sean Hannity, says we've pretty much shut this down. Alex Greninger, who you mentioned, said that from February 4th to February 26th, we were pretty much blind as far as testing goes. Explain a little bit, if you can, these early messages from Washington, D.C., saying this is contained, we have it totally under control. There's a ban on travel from China early on that the president has repeatedly returned to as a success story. But these people in Washington state have said, we no more had this under control. We just didn't have access to testing. Which, did that give a false sense of security to the president? Did he help us understand how those two things, how those two cities were so disconnected in those early days? Because a lot of people from Washington state saw this very differently than what people saw in Washington, D.C.
I think the key point here, Lori, is do we listen to the smart people, the experts? And I would say it's pretty safe to say that the people who make policy here in the state of Washington, from the governor on down, put science and facts and data at the center of their decision making. And that's a simple notion. We have really smart people, in particular here in the Seattle area, very smart people who know a lot about this stuff, who are saying this is of great concern, we need to do things. And in the other Washington, we've had decades of discounting of science. I'm thinking a little bit about climate change here, of course, but the idea that when scientists tell you things you don't want to hear for whatever reason, either it offends your ideology or it might affect your bottom line, you belittle the scientist and you inject doubt on them and their motivations and consider them politically motivated. So science, unfortunately, has been politicized in an unfortunate way. And this manifested itself in the middle of a pandemic, which has incredibly grave consequences. You know, people, when you don't listen to the experts who tell you that this thing is happening, people die. And so there's this divergent approach to whether you want to listen to the expertise that is out there that we have in this country. We have the smartest people who understand this, but we're not always listening in the political realm.
We are going to talk more with Miles O'Brien after a quick break. We're talking about tonight's Frontline Coronavirus Pandemic, A Tale of Two Washingtons, and you can watch it at pbs.org/frontline on the PBS video app, or you can tune in to SDPB TV tonight at 8 Central, 7 Mountain. We'll be back with more on this conversation in just a moment. You're on listener-supported SDPB Radio. Welcome back to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. We're talking this hour with Miles O'Brien. He's the director and correspondent for a new frontline investigation, Coronavirus Pandemic, A Tale of Two Washingtons. You can see it tonight at 8 p.m. Central, 7 Mountain on SDPB TV. You can also see it 2 hours before that on the PBS video app and online at pbs.org/frontline. Miles, I want to talk. You mentioned this hospital in Seattle who had just run a pandemic response drill and was really ready with a, you know, under 2 hour response time to the first suspected COVID-19 patient, which turned out to be confirmed. There's also, you talked with the mayor of Seattle, who also had a pandemic plan on the shelf, which had recently been reviewed and updated. Tell me a little bit about the mayor of Seattle, some of the actions she took, how Microsoft played into the decisions to act so swiftly from a social distancing standpoint in the absence of mass testing or an effective test at all at that point.
Yeah, it was interesting to me how prepared the people were here, how much they were thinking about this. The fact that there were pandemic response plans on the shelf that were had been updated and drilled, and people were sort of poised for this. As much as anything else, Lori, the fact that COVID-19 was documented first here in this area is because people were really ready for it. They were looking for it. They were ready. They were prepared. They were kind of spring loaded for this, what has unfolded in the rest of the country. And when the mayor and others became aware of the problems at the Life Care nursing home in Kirkland, Washington, dozens of elderly folks coming down with a respiratory problem, which quickly was determined to be the coronavirus, they acted almost spontaneously, really without, you know, legal proclamations or orders. And the business community, Microsoft being a leader in that function, without really much urging at all, just shut down business. And so that what we've become accustomed to all across this country, people working from home, staying at home, social distancing, happened almost organically here. It's pretty extraordinary how quickly people fell in line. There wasn't any, the messages were very clear. The public messaging was clear. So the policymakers were listening to the experts, were communicating that to the public. And then the business community was not pushing back either. So it's an extraordinary example of how to do it well when there's an emergency, how to have the messages be cohesive and not confusing and contradictory, and to ultimately have the business community go along. And that, generally speaking, has brought the public around with them. I mean, it's if you look at the numbers here, and to some extent, what is happening here is kind of the nation's future since they were first. But the numbers appear to be going down. It's difficult when you're in the middle of it to say for certain you've had your peak, but there's every reason to believe that has happened here. And that is the only thing that changed is everybody stayed at home and stayed apart from each other. One thing about viruses that we don't have any immunity for, they certainly don't peter out that way on their own.
The president of the United States called Jay Inslee, the governor of Washington State, a snake, and has been not very complimentary to the mayor of Seattle either. And she's had some strong words. Both, Mayor Durkin and Governor Inslee have had strong words back and forth for the president, which, again, was sort of an early sign of how many governors would speak out against the president and what the president would say to governors and certain governors who, agree with the president, very supportive of his stance, others who are not. So let's talk about federalism and this response. And let's begin with this idea that these governors were largely in a free-for-all for personal protective equipment, testing kits. They had to fight with each other for the supplies that they needed. Talk a little bit about how early those frustrations were arising from individual governors.
Yeah, I mean, of course, the political rhetoric is one thing. Governor Inslee was the first to issue a state of emergency in any state in the nation. And it was right around that time that he tweeted out, and I'm paraphrasing, that the president and the administration should pay attention to science and the facts. And that's what engendered a day or so later at the Centers for Disease Control. The president was there telling the media that anybody in the country who needed a test could get a test, which, of course, was false then and is false today, and then went into a diatribe calling the governor a snake. Now, that kind of political rhetoric at a time of global emergency, a pandemic that literally jeopardizes every person on the planet is unfortunate and a distraction. And people here viewed it as a distraction. Now, to the point of resources, without the federal government marshaling resources, without the president using his authority to turn the nation's manufacturing power on a dime to get supplies to answer this need, and his statements that the governors can do this and should do this on their own, it became the term that Mayor Durkan uses here in Seattle. It became the Hunger Games between the governors, and there would be shipments of personal protective equipment arriving at the port in California, masks and so forth. And it became, when it became evident they were there, governors would get into a bidding war for this gear. Well, that is no way to respond to a pandemic that threatens the nation and threatens the world. It's an unfortunate, and you know, the governors ultimately had no choice, right? They had to represent their constituency and advocate for them. But it cries out, as you say, this is a classic example of why we have a federal government. Fundamentally, why we need a federal government is to protect us from threats which extend beyond the resources and capabilities of the states. And this is, if you don't employ a federal approach to this, what would you employ it for? And so we're still seeing that today. We still see that pushback from the president on this idea of testing is the thing right now, that he contends the governors have the capability and the wherewithal to do it. But I've seen it firsthand here. There's absolutely no way they can do it on their own.
Tell me what kind of do-it-yourself workarounds you saw in Washington with people trying to make their own personal protective equipment in order to keep healthcare workers safe. What did you see people doing? What kind of creativity and desperation?
Desperation is exactly the word. I got to know the chief clinical officer for the Providence St. Joseph Hospital Network. It's a very large chain of hospitals, I think 51 hospitals on the West Coast. Amy Confin Phillips is her name. She's the number four person in the enterprise. It's a big job. She's marshals thousands of people under her watch as a manager. And I caught up with her at the otherwise vacant headquarters for Providence in a large conference room. And she and her top management team were in this room, safely spread out. They had raided six craft stores nearby, and they were making face shields, arts and crafts style, sewing circle style. And it was, on the one hand, I walked in and I was kind of got me a little misty, because it made me it was an inspiring scene in some respects to see them, you know, rallying. But then when you started thinking about really what was happening here, it was very, very sad and unfortunate. And that's, you know, as Dr. Compton Phillips put it to me, she said, I would rather them have homemade PPE, personal protective equipment, than none at all. And so we're going to do what we can. Now, in the course of a couple of days, they made 1,000 face shields. Totally a tiny little dent in the need, given the number of cases here. But to the extent that it empowered her people and made them feel like they were doing something when there were no alternatives, there they were. So I think it's unfortunate, as Juliette Kayyem, former Department of Homeland Security official during the Obama days, said in our film, to protect your frontline health, I'm paraphrasing, by the way, to protect your frontline healthcare workers in a crisis like this, relying on essentially sewing circles is frankly pathetic.
I want to get in our remaining minutes about to what's next, because it ties into this production. If we know that massive testing is the way to get the economy going and massive contact tracing, and we need testing supplies, we need personal protective equipment for the people doing the testing, we have the Defense Production Act in the president's pocket. What the heck? Why can't, you know, we've had a few months now. It's very frustrating to get through this documentary and to read the news and to listen to people talk and say, Why haven't we solved that problem yet? We're America. We have manufacturers all across this country, and you're telling me we can't figure out how to get enough test kits and gowns and masks to the people doing the testing to make a dent in this problem? Help us understand what the holdup is there.
Well, Lori, I consider it a compliment that my film made you frustrated, right? Because I have been, I actually do, because I have been beating my head against the wall trying to figure out why this is happening in our great and glorious country. This is the, in the World War II, we called it the arsenal of democracy. I grew up in the Detroit area. There's these famous stories of Henry Ford turning automobile assembly lines into B-24 bomber assembly lines almost overnight. And rolling one off the assembly line in less than an hour, each one in less than an hour. I mean, extraordinary. The reason we won World War II is because of logistics and supplies. That's really the secret sauce, right? And to say that's not important is just not understanding how you fight wars. And this is a war. And it is frustrating to imagine that a president who has said not too long ago he has complete and total authority seems reluctant to use one of the things where he does have complete and total authority, which is to use the Defense Production Act to force industry, order industry to make things. He can do that. And for reasons I don't have the insight on that sitting here in Seattle, but so far he's been the allegation among governors and others is that he's been very slow to employ this technique. I don't have any understanding why that is, but we can solve this pretty easily in this country. We're good at this stuff, but it does require a cohesive federal strategy and leadership.
Governor Inslee says the most dangerous element in the virus is complacency, and now we're looking at a time where people are getting anxious. They want they can't pay their rent. They're getting hungry. They need to go back to work. They're tired of staying inside voluntarily. We're having issues in South Dakota about what kind of events we can have. So much is happening. We don't have this massive testing. We don't have protective equipment, not only for a surge in our hospitals, but to test the number of people that we need. What is the risk of just going back to normal that Governor Inslee is sort of warning about? And how is Washington kind of going forward? We really just have a minute to wrap it up here, Miles.
Well, I'll just say it quickly. What you had happen there at the pork processing facility is exactly the risk. Until we know who's sick, who isn't sick, who's been sick, who's immune, you can't think about reopening and having people working in close proximity in a food production plant. So we need to get testing and testing many orders of magnitude bigger than we're doing it right now. The states cannot do this on their own. The federal government has to step in and help get these supply chains going. So we can test in a way that allows us to imagine returning to our lives. It can be done. We can't be defeatist about this, but we also can't be impatient either. Going outside, eliminating the precautions that we've taken right now prematurely, we're going to be right back in the weeds in June or July.
Miles O'Brien, thank you for giving us extended time today. We really appreciate this frontline and we appreciate your time. Be safe and stay well, please.
You're welcome, Lori.